Mikey.
Yes.
I've been reading this book, man. It's a German book. It's called The Healing of the World, The Golden Age of Medicine, 1840 to 1914. And it's just amazing how far we've come since then, since the 1840s. It's written by this German author living in the States called Ronald Gerste. You would probably call him Ronald Gersty or something, or Jersty or something. That's what you do to our names. Admit it.
Yeah, no, we murder
Admit
him.
Admit it.
Yeah.
Amazing book. Talks about all this medical advance. Like, for example, invention of narcosis, first narcosis. Finding out that cholera is actually transmitted via drinking water in London. So there's all these episodes. One of them talks about also just the basic effect of hygiene, like hand washing in a hospital. Who knew that this
might
help people from not getting infected and dying after an operation, or women who had given birth and not getting infected in the uterus and also dying from that.
That's so,
quite amazing how far we've come, right?
It's crazy to me that basically just soap has saved so many more lives than almost any other technology we've developed. Like, it's amazing that just like moving the little bugs off of our hands and off of our bodies has just like, there's so many lives.
It's a wonderful read. So far only in German, I think, available. I hope it gets translated to English. For our German listeners, Die Heilung der Welt, published in Klett-Cotta Verlag. This is the Americanist podcast. My name is Johannes Ehrmann in Berlin, Germany. And I'm joined, as every time, by my dear friend and accomplished scholar over in Stanford, California, Mike Baiocchi. We're going to talk about healthcare. It started with this book that I've read, because I realized that the German public healthcare system is actually as old as 1883. And it was invented or introduced by famous politician Otto von Bismarck, the Chancellor of the German Reich. Not this one, don't worry. The one before. So Bismarck, a very Prussian sea lion of a man with a huge mustache, you know, you can imagine the guy, right? Basically being born with like a steel hat. So he introduced this law concerning the health insurance of workers. And actually the word in German is not health insurance, but we literally say insurance of the sick, Krankenversicherung. So we kind of do it the other way around. And the interesting thing is that Bismarck didn't do that because he loved the workers so much or because he was just this beneficial dude. He was a politician. He cared about his power and the emperor. Yeah. And so he basically, the safety net, so from what I found, the safety net before that for people had been mostly the churches, the families, the unions. And he tried to veer people a little bit away from that, especially industrial and agricultural workers.
Super interesting.
Yeah, when was the American public healthcare system started?
Yeah, well, first off, I don't think we have public health, you're already rubbing it in. Jerk. Yeah, I mean, like, maybe kind of equivalent to the book that you were reading is an awesome book by Paul Starr. I think it was like written in the 80s now, so it's almost like 40 years old. But it's called The Social Transformation of American Medicine or something like that. And it traces American medicine and sort of how our physicians started from like basically the start of our country, probably to like the 1880s or something like that. So roughly like, you know, dropping off right around when you're...
And we should say, when your country started, because I'm just researching this for my next book, medicine was kind of like bloodletting, purging, which means... I didn't know that means actually just making people vomit.
Well, yeah, yes, it basically... I mean, they also would, like, evacuate people's bowels. They would, like, induce... Like basically, yes.
Any direction.
Okay. Any direction. Anything out the nose. Like, they would do everything.
Sweet. Yeah, and just... I don't know, I guess leeches, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Just Yeah. Just
because this is the point where they were believing like humors and imbalances of the energies of the body and that kind of stuff. They would talk about like the black humors and the yellow humors, and like they're basically looking at like different like parts of the like digestive system. Yeah.
And so they basically had no idea what they were doing.
Yeah, absolutely no idea what they're doing.
Okay.
But it's interesting. So this book, first off, excellent. It's sort of interesting because like in the United States, we have not had a lot of like political organizations. Let me see. Workers, like unions have never like done a super, have never like sustained themselves for very long. But physicians saw the sort of collective bargaining, the institutionalization, and they jumped on it really early. So it's really interesting to read this because like early on in the Americas, like there were physicians who were sort of like diagnostics. Then there were surgeons who were, you know, scalpels and cutting in and that kind of stuff. And then there were like apothecaries or like, you know, pharmacists, like precursors to pharmacists. And these were thought of as three very different groups. Mm-hmm. And actually, interestingly, surgeons were essentially perfectly synonymous with like butchers, like actual like cutting of the meats,
cutting of limbs, basically, yeah, in the wars, and
yeah, exactly,
because there was no other way to treat even infections, right? This is also in the book that I read.
Just to be clear, these are actually basically the same exact people who would also cut your meats for the weekend, like, you know, for your family dinner, like, so they were almost perfectly affiliated. The idea was that like it was the scalpels, the cutting, the sharp instruments that were,
or the saws.
Yeah. Yeah, saws. Yes, that's right. Yeah, going through the bones.
Is it? Because they didn't just cut off the pinky.
No, it was not a. This is not an elegant science at this point.
Yeah.
Here in the United States, it's actually really interesting to hear you talk about like the German development, because here it was sort of an American spin on it, where the individuals who were thinking of themselves as men of medicine, and it was basically just men at this point, and physicians, they wanted to harness political power. So they started like a credentialing program. Actually, the very first medical college was at Penn.
Oh.
University of Penn, with a precursor to University of Pennsylvania. Yeah, it was the first accrediting institution on this. And so they started doing credentialing and that kind of stuff. So they basically grabbed the power before the state could. And they formed like medical colleges, they formed institutional groups and that kind of stuff. So they've been holding on to this power that they made both like sort of capitalist and sort of individuals get to hold the right to give medicine or withhold medicine or that kind of stuff. They held that. And then later on, once they had enough power, then they basically made the state recognize in an official capacity the credentialing process. Mm-hmm. So the power has been sectioned off, carved out, and basically made private, essentially from the get-go. Oh. So it's really interesting to hear.
So
that
even
you guys
before there was medicine, the medical personnel was already protecting their elite status.
That's exactly right. Well, that's actually, so that's super interesting part of it too, is like at the time when they were doing this, the physicians were starting to try to grab this power. Their argument was like, hey, we are experts in making people and keeping people healthy. And the best argument at the time against it was like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
The best argument at that time was like, your outcomes are no better than anybody else's. Like, we should go to like, yeah, natural healers and that kind of stuff. And they were basically right. I mean, it looked like the outcomes at that period, like American physicians had no idea what they were doing.
It's interesting because I always thought it was mostly your innate belief in the infinite power of the individual to pull themselves out of any misery and also sickness.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if those interplay,
mm-hmm.
right? Like one of the things that you and I have talked about this before, but like it's really interesting to hear you when you do your first person or like, what do you say, primary sources research, because when you do that, and I hear you talk about it, I realize that I see the history, like American history, through a lens. Like, so mm-hmm. I'm looking at it from 2020.
Mm-hmm.
I see America in the 1770s
mm-hmm.
through the lens of whatever the 1940s here, how they saw it, and how the 1800s saw, you know. So
mm-hmm.
I suspect that part of what's going on here is that the foundation of the American individualism probably also was being co-developed by physicians and like sort of thinking about like, it's not a state level thing. It is, we're going to control the political power, which is probably the original impetus. But it was like part of their arguments became, you know, this is an individual person that we're healing. It's going to be the powers between me and this individual. And you can still see that today. And so I think there's probably a co-development between American ideas of individualism and probably medicine.
Yeah. And I also love that they used to call this era before the 1840s, with all the bloodletting, purging, and cutting of limbs, the age of heroic medicine. So heroes were at work there. sounds very American.
Yeah, it really does. And it also, you basically had to be a hero because you're gonna die if we don't. We didn't actually get you healthy. We just killed all the people who were sick.
Yeah, and inflicted a lot of pain while doing so.
Oh God, yeah, right.
Because this is also, I mean, before narcosis, can you just even imagine just amputations or even just a tooth being pulled out?
Yeah. You, like, high probability of dying, right?
Yeah, or at least having, so much pain.
Your teeth are rotting out and we're just going to yank them.
Yep. Before we move to this question, what's going on with the American system? So I've pulled up a little bit historical facts on the German system here as we started talking about Bismarck. So in the very beginning, the costs were split between the workers and their employers. And the workers actually had to pay 2/3 of the premiums, you would say, and 1/3 was coming from the employers. State was not paying anything on top. So this was moving up from initially less than 10% of the population, mostly industrial and agricultural workers, to now roughly 90% of the population falling under this public sector of health insurance. So that's 73 million German people currently. Which does not mean, however, that the other 10% are without a health insurance. But there's also a smaller sort of elite, if you want, side arm of the system, the private health sector, that's covering around 9 million Germans on top of that. So there is a universal healthcare here.
Yeah. And does that elite system, do they get better access or to different doctors or fat? Yeah. What are you getting in that premium?
Yeah, better access, quicker dates for an MRI, for example, or very expensive procedures. Sometimes it's different doctors. There's only some doctors who are a private practice. A lot of doctors offer both. There's, of course, also an inherent inequality there, because sometimes they would ask you, what's your insurance, and you tell them, and if it's a public insurance, then it's the next one is in 8 weeks, and if it's a private and they can bill you, I think it's 6 or 7 times more sometimes.
Oh my gosh.
Then it's you want to come in tomorrow? And currently this also has changed since the beginning for the public sector. Now it's split 50-50 between the employer and the employee. And it makes up currently around 14.6% of your monthly wages. So it can vary a little bit depending on your insurer. But there's a quota that's set by the state for that. There's actually not only one public health insurance. There's roughly 100 different in Germany.
Oh, yeah.
In what sense?
Like, is it state?
Different insurers that also compete in a way for additional benefits. So it's mostly, the general care has to be the same. But additional benefits, for example, around birth or sickness or glasses or cancer screenings, or also alternative healing methods. This is my favorite word in pronunciation in English, osteopathy. Osteopathy. It actually started in the US, I found out, 1874. Oh. Yeah, in Kansas. Yeah. So that's how they're competing. And if you think 100 different is a lot, in 1970 there were 1800, and in 1990 there were still 1000. So there's a lot of mergers. So they're trying to also gather strength also to compete with each other. So it's getting less and less, but still you have a choice of, if you ever lived in Germany, you could choose between 100 different roughly public health insurers. Go private, of course. I think as an American, you would have to go private, right?
the ways they pull away.
You want it. You want it.
Yeah, I was like, ooh. I can crowd out someone else. Ooh.
But tell me, but I'm interested because I always thought with Obamacare, you guys now have a universal system, but it's not the case.
No. So first off, it's interesting that you have 100 insurance. I guess technically we may have something like that, but in fact, in practice, there's something like 80 to 90% of our market is dominated by four insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
So Obamacare was sort of what it did was it made sure that everybody could have access to health insurance. So here in the United States, since its inception, there's been no guarantee that you would be able to have health insurance if you were below the age of 65. Okay. So there's Medicare, which is designed basically for a long time, if you survived here in the United States to be sort of like retirement age, it was not clear that you would have enough money to be in retirement. Mm-hmm. And a huge chunk of that came from, medical costs. And so at some point we decided ethically we could not continue to allow our senior citizens to go into bankruptcy and so we built a public insurance option that essentially everybody is on. It's very similar to yours, where the vast majority, 90% or something like that, I would guess, are on purely just a public option, and then there's a buy-up premium version that people. And so it's very, in terms of the rough outline, it's very similar to what you're talking about, mm-hmm. above mm-hmm. the age of 65.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But below that, oh my gosh, it's a mess. It's a total disaster. And Obamacare, what it did was it allowed people who were falling through the cracks, people who didn't have a lot of money. Oh, here in the United States, our insurance is almost completely tied to your employer. This is a bizarre, mm-hmm. doesn't have to happen. It's awful. And a lot of mm-hmm. Americans don't even realize this. But our access is essentially controlled. What kinds of health insurance you can get, which insurers you can use. All that stuff is chosen by your employer. And then, and if you lose your job or you switch your job, you lose your health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And so Obamacare basically stepped in to offer plans that could be portable, that you could move between different mm-hmm. employers. And if you weren't employed, you could also get health insurance.
I think that's also a very big difference, right? I mean, the state is not so much a big actor in this whole game of healthcare as it is in Germany, which might also have historical connotations. Because, I mean, people should know that the German national state didn't even exist before 1871.
Right.
So this is almost 100 years later than the US came into being as a national state.
You guys actually play a role in our current healthcare disaster. So a big chunk of insurance here in the United States didn't really exist until World War II. So during World War, this is the big story of how we are.
And how's that linked to Germany? Were we involved in the?
I have no idea what we're talking about. So this is bizarre. Okay, this is the weirdest story for how we ended up in this mess. So in the 40s, as we were gearing up to fight people who we won't name.
The Hans, the Krauts, the Fritzes.
The Congress decided that. Oh, okay. This is how it worked. Is they decided that because a lot of men were disappearing from the workforce and women were entering the workforce, companies that were starting to compete and wages, with wages to really increase. And they were really worried about two things. One is women getting economic power, which is a disaster. Mm-hmm. I can't believe we mm-hmm. whatever. But they talked about that. The mm-hmm. other thing is that they were worried about causing massive inflation. Mm-hmm. So it's not wise, but they put a cap on wages here in the United States during World War II. Mm-hmm. But we also just needed a bunch of people to be in the workforce. So it was very crazy. People were not doing smart things. But here's the insane part is companies were trying to figure out how they could attract employees. And they realized that if there was no restriction on benefits, so life insurance and health insurance and pensions became really popular during this period. And here's the really weird quirk to all of this is that the tax collecting policy, there was a very ambiguous subsection of the tax. I'm not kidding. This is how crazy this is. Some ambiguous subsection of a subsection, the tax law, made it kind of sound like the government would not tax benefits. So if we like offered pensions, they wouldn't mm-hmm. tax it. If they offered health insurance, they wouldn't tax it. And so it is ambiguous. So a couple companies asked for clarification, and it looks like historically, it didn't even go all the way to the top of the IRS, our tax organization. Yeah. It went to like some mid-level bureaucrat, and the mid-level bureaucrat was like, yes, the interpretation is that we will not tax benefits. And this is why we have health insurance like so crazy here in the United States, is like it became a tax benefit. They were saving 20 or 30%.
It's the eternal American promise, right? Oh. Tax deduction.
Yes.
Lowering your taxes. Wonderful.
So when that happened, like all of a sudden, these companies are competing for employees, and then they have to like, they made it private insurance, and so they were like competing that way. And so everything got locked into your employer. Your employers were seeing tax advantages. Wages got pushed down. It was just like, it was a series of crazy disasters, and that has left us where we are now. And that's why we have no public health insurance.
One thing I'm also trying to understand is why the U.S. spending on healthcare is so much higher than everywhere else, basically in the developed world. And I've pulled up these numbers. So the U.S. spends $11,000 per capita per year, and the comparable country average is 5,700. So it's almost double that. Germany is at 6,300. But the U.S. is just, and there's a graph also we can link to. It's just insane. There's like there's a curve, and then the U.S. is just somewhere in the sky. You know, why is this? Is it because it's the private system, and there's just these huge? I mean, medicine is expensive, and no one is putting a hold on that, or
There's a couple. I mean, there's like several things going on here. Like, let me start with the apologists, like so the people who try to defend the American system, what they say, and I think this is sort of the best version of their argument, is there are two parts to it. One is America is also by far the biggest innovator in medicine. Mm-hmm. We build the best technologies. We have the best. This is not, by the way, debatable. Okay, I mean it's true.
Yeah, I mean that's why an American company invented this wonderful new vaccine. It's called BioNTech. Oh no, wait, it was a German company, right? But they needed the Americans to market it. Yeah, I know.
We marketed. We needed you to market it.
Yeah, hats off to Pfizer.
So there's that. Plus the other. Here's the other part of their argument is. America is also a very rich country, and basically what you're seeing, this is their argument, is that because we have so much disposable income, it makes a ton of sense for us to spend that on health, because we want to be happier, we want to live longer. Mm. Like, that's a very good value proposition. Once you get past a certain level of income, allocating it toward medicine makes a lot of sense. You're just going to be a better like quality of life. Does this totally make sense when you compare us to Germany or, you know, like the Nordic countries? No, it doesn't. But like those are the, I think, the two best arguments to sort of apologize for this. What is actually happening, as far as I can tell, at least two things. One is that because of our insurance system, because it's private, it is hugely market distorting. There's a bunch of people who are taking value out. So there's a lot of confusion on like what the prices are. Mm. So that kind of stuff is happening. So the insurance company takes 20%. The doctors will sort of upcharge and try to reallocate money across different patients. Some who are very, well compensating patients, some are not. So there's a lot of shifting around and murkiness, and it's very hard to see the prices. So that, and that comes almost purely and is almost intentional from our private insurance system. And we can talk about that in detail at some other point, but it's very clearly the case that our health insurance here is intentionally distorted. The other thing is, because the costs are not coming out of my pocket as an American immediately, I don't have any incentive to limit the amount of cost. There's nobody who's immediately obviously holding the costs. Mm. So I might decide to go for a more expensive procedure, in part because I don't know how much it's going to cost, but also because the cost will be borne by, I think, my employer. Mm. My employer, on the other hand, like sees it as a way of, compensating me. So they're just going to you know, when there's an increase next year, they won't give me a bigger wage, but that's fine because like I'm getting what I want from the health insurance. So, and then the government has no incentive to keep the prices low because that would reduce GDP. So like, it's just the craziest system here in the United States where nobody feels responsible for controlling the costs. Employers don't see it that way. The people purchasing, all that stuff.
And it probably also doesn't help if you have these four or five major players, like you said before, with a lot of concentration of power and capital.
Yeah.
And makes it much easier, I guess, to kind of negotiate the prices also among them.
And here's another thing. This is a little bit on the side here, but just to give you a sense of how weird it is in America, because we pay in premiums to these four or five major insurers, they have a huge percentage of the stock market. So if we were to break up these companies, I don't know, 60% of the American stock market would disappear or be like, when Obamacare was going on, like there were very serious considerations about what would happen to the liquidity of these markets because a lot of the premium that gets put in there is immediately put and invested into these kinds of like.
So you're gonna have to email me these names. Maybe I'm gonna have to reallocate some of my stocks to them. It seems like they seem to be doing pretty well.
These are very lucrative companies. These are I mean, I would go toe to toe with them like back in the day. That was before I became a professor. Like that was my job, was to negotiate with them. So we got to see their books of business and know exactly what their profit margins were and that kind of stuff, which is super fascinating. That's actually what got me into thinking about data.
Yeah, so this was one of the things that amazed me the most out of your graduate time in the University of Pennsylvania. You actually helped the university out with their healthcare, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to have to share that story now because it was our cliffhanger last week.
So when I was in consulting, I was here. Actually, I worked for Stanford. In part, one of my clients was Stanford. So I got to know this company that was providing health insurance to the students at Stanford. And, you know, I got their data, but it was sort of like a struggle because they didn't want to let us see the data. They didn't want to. And so like it was always a battle with this company. And because I was a consultant, I wasn't the client. Things would get very tense with their data analyst, their actuary, the person who was pricing from the insurance side. His name was Paul, and he had a really bad Boston accent. So he would, call him Boston Paul. Boston Paul was annoyed by me, this 20-something kid who was really trying to get his numbers and prove that he was wrong, that he should not be charging as much for Stanford. So that was always a frustration. I did that for about 3 years with Stanford, and then I moved to Penn. And then when I was at Penn, I was, again, Penn was using the same health insurance company. And again, it turns out that it was Boston Paul again, who was the insurer. But this time I was now the client. And so that was actually a lot of fun because he could no longer deny me the data I wanted. So I got to pull in every stream of data. Yeah, he had to give it to me quickly. I got to see all. So I got looking in the data. And for the 6 years before I got there, this insurance company was overcharging by $1 million to $2 million per year. So there was an agreed upon price, but because of how they were charging, it wasn't obvious, but they were overcharging by $1 million. And this was coming right out of student paychecks. This was coming right out. But again, parents' it was a very ambiguous. Say again?
Out of parents' pockets.
Parents' pockets, exactly. And because nobody, this is a very confusing system, and nobody quite knew how to look at their pricing. Nobody quite knew. And so I presented this to the students and to the faculty and in front of Boston Paul. And it was just stunned silence. Nobody had realized how much they were overcharging us. And it had totaled up to something like $10 million over the recent part of the contract. And so, we ended up negotiating an extremely cool contract, which is they guaranteed that they would if we won, we got to keep money, and if they won, they would give us the money back. So they capped it moving into the future. I don't know if they still have that contract that we negotiated, but they realized that they had been caught so badly that they gave us a one-sided contract for a handful of years afterwards.
Very well done, Mike.
That was kind of satisfying.
Proud of you, man. Maybe just one last aspect that I also found in preparation for this question, why is there no universal healthcare in the US? There's a New York Times article from 2019 that's arguing one of the reasons for that is one word, race. So relations in the US.
Yeah.
What they mean by that basically after the Civil War was won in the 1860s and the slave population was freed, then the Southern Democrats at the time, who were lobbying against equality of the minorities, they effectively, blocked any form of legislation that would have provided a more universal healthcare benefit to minority populations.
I mean, it's such a powerful story in the United States over and over again that we carve out part of what it means to be American, like, and what it means to like sort of protect each other and that kind of stuff. We keep carving out certain groups, African Americans over and over again have been pushed out of these kinds of programs, and it just is so hard. And that still very much happens. Like in the 80s and 90s, there was discussion of like welfare queens, which was a reference, an oblique reference to black women, and they didn't want to give insurance and social support to these people. I should have said that earlier. That's a really important part of the story too, about why we don't have a really good public health system. Is there's a lot of pressure not to help everybody.
But to tie this back to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, also notably the first black president that's brought health insurance to nearly 20 million, I believe, previously uninsured adults.
Right.
And a lot of them were the people that fell through the cracks of the system before, as you said earlier. A lot of them also blacks and other minorities, right?
A huge percentage, yeah. Mm. And from different parts of the country, too. I mean, like, it's not, I think it's correct to talk about African Americans and the burden they've had. There's a lot of Hispanics in the Southwest. There's a lot of like really poor white folk from like sort of the mid-Atlantic, north part of the South, sort of Mason-Dixon line area, and like these people just get pushed way to the side over and over again, and that's what that system really helped.
So change has been happening after all.
Yeah.
What's your outlook? Will things improve further? Is there kind of like a backlash?
It's an interesting, one of the arguments, and this was an argument that was made back in like when I was in consulting, so in the early 2000s, was the rate of increase in our health insurance, health care here in the United States was something like annually, it was like 10%. So the costs were sort of going up, the amount of allocation. And someone was like, it can't keep doing that. It literally can't. Like, it just, that's not something that's sustainable. It's going to have to do something. And so the argument, and I think this is probably where we're at, is it's sort of like either things will explode, like in the sense that like we will cease to be able to offer health insurance. Like there, a huge chunk of the American population won't get it, or this system will cease to exist and another one will have to take its place because it doesn't protect enough people and it costs too much and it increases at a rate that's not sustainable, so it can't be sustained, so the system will crash. That's a very blunt argument, but it's correct. I mean, that like if it can't be sustained, then it won't. So either you'll see some major political force emerge that will have to restructure it, or maybe like the corporations themselves will have to sort of change how they're offering benefits and doing the cost controls. But it literally just can't keep going on this way, except for I'm a little bit wrong because, I mean, it did slow down. The rates are no longer like 10% per year. I forget what the most recent one was, but it's more like 5 or 6 now, which is still higher than inflation and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, there's no obvious, thing that's going to change in the short run, but it's not a system that's built for the long run. It was not an intentional system. I mean, that's like part of the story that I was telling you is like, It came out of an accidental tax benefit that wasn't well thought out at all.
All right. This was today's episode of The Americanist. Please do subscribe to us and leave a favorable rating on iTunes. Next time, we'll talk about...
Sleepy Joe.
Yes, that's my man. Man from Pennsylvania. Sleepy. And yeah. We'll see how many people his German shepherds will have bitten until then. And yeah, we'll be happy to talk about all his plans to fix, well, basically everything.
Yeah, basically everything.
Thanks so much, Mikey, for your insight. And yeah, talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Later, dude.